I've only got four slides, and two of them are the same, so I thought I'd do a little advertising while I have the space. I want to start out by telling you something that maybe you didn't know already, and that is that Wendy is a real person. She is the daughter, the youngest daughter of our founder, Dave Thomas, and her real name is Melinda. She had a couple older sisters who had trouble pronouncing her name, and so Melinda became Wenda, and that eventually turned into Wendy, which is still the name that she goes by today. And she's not a little girl anymore. She's about my age, a little bit younger maybe. But the little girl with the red pigtails that you see on the sign out front is a friend of the beef industry, believe me. Wendy's restaurants sell almost 400 million pounds of beef every year. We're not as big as McDonald's, we're not as big as Burger King, but we're trying very hard to make that number grow. I jumped at this opportunity to be with you today because it's not often that we, being at complete opposite ends of the marketing chain, have the chance to communicate directly with each other. You represent the point at which beef production begins. And of course, we interface directly with the consumer of your product. There's a lot that happens in between and a lot of people involved in between, and I'm sure that your day-to-day issues are quite different from ours. But the truth is that our customers and your customers are one and the same. So we should have common goals. We do everything we can to present beef to our customers in precisely the way that they want it. But we don't make the beef. You make it. You make it, and we try to create demand for it. And so the better we're able to coordinate our efforts, the better off we're both going to be in the long run. And that's why I'm here today. I hope that you'll leave here today with a better understanding of how Wendy's tries to satisfy its customers and what we look to the beef industry for to help us achieve our goals. What I want to do today is to give you a picture of what our beef supply chain looks like, how we go about trying to create demand for beef, and how this relates to your business. But first, I guess I owe it to you to tell you who I am. I am the Director of Supply Chain Management for Wendy's International, and I have responsibility for the procurement of beef, pork, produce, and French fries for all of the Wendy's restaurants and our subsidiaries in North America. Renee, you want to punch the button and I'll show you what Wendy's International consists of. We have 6,495 restaurants, Wendy's restaurants, 2,348 Tim Hortons restaurants, and if you have ever been to Canada, I know that you know who Tim Hortons is. Tim Hortons is, in fact, the largest restaurant chain of any kind in Canada. And we own 299 Baja Fresh Mexican grills. We also own a majority interest in Cafe Express, which is in Texas, and which, by the way, features a half-pound Angus burger on their menu. And we also have part ownership of a small but growing chain called Pasta Pomodoro in California and Arizona. I'm 46 years old, so I'll save you the guesswork. I have been involved in the meat business ever since I got out of school, which I'm not sure is anything to be particularly proud of either. But I have a master's degree in agricultural economics. I was a commodity broker for 6 years. I worked for USDA in Washington as a livestock and meat industry analyst. I worked for this co-op called Topco for 13 years, which is actually a cooperative that's owned by supermarket chains and distributors across the country. And I did that before I joined up with Wendy's a couple years ago. I grew up in the Lutheran Church, which somehow gives me a certain level of comfort being in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. For a Lutheran traveling to South Dakota, it's not dissimilar from a Muslim going to Mecca. This is sort of a hotbed for radical Lutheranism. And I have my ingrained in me, in my blood, the basic Lutheran values, which are not written down anywhere, I don't think, but I'm sure that some of you know what they are. They're simple things like, don't think you're somebody because you're not. We can't stay, we really have to get back. And those people never should have been there in the first place. These values don't serve you particularly well in the business world, but then I guess Lutherans are generally not well known for being savvy business people. Anyway, I thought it might be helpful to show you what our beef supply network looks like. Renee, that would be the next one. There you go. This is our U.S. beef supply chain on this map here. Our beef supply chain is a carefully designed and closely controlled network of raw material producers, in other words, packers, slaughter plants, beef patty processors, and distributors. In this map, the stars represent the patty processing plants. There are six in the U.S. and two in Canada, which you don't see up there. And the dots represent the distribution centers. I didn't include the slaughter plants on this map because I put them on there and then it got all messed up and it was hard to read, but they are up there too. And each patty processor has a dedicated set of slaughter plants assigned to it. And you'll understand a little bit more about why that is when I start talking about traceback and things like that. But each our raw material supplies and pricing formulas are contracted in advance. Each patty processor is a contract supplier to Wendy's, and they are paid a fixed amount per pound for their services. Likewise, each distribution center is a contract supplier for Wendy's, and they are paid a fixed amount per case to deliver the whole array of Wendy's products to the store. Our beef is delivered into the stores in 40-pound cases of 2 and 4 ounce patties, and each store will go through about 30 cases per week on average, or about 1,200 pounds. Wendy's product specifications are pretty tight by industry standards. The beef has to be delivered to the restaurant within 4 days of production, and it has to be served within 8 days of production. So the restaurant has 4 days to bring it in and move it out. And I'll tell you why. By the way, that's about half of the time allowed for most retail packaged ground beef. Would you agree with that? It was my experience at Topco. A 15-day shelf life is pretty common. I'll tell you why that standard is as it is. It's not so much because of food safety. If the product is handled properly, the microbial counts in the meat are not significantly different at 10 or 12 days of age than they are at 8. It has to do with the organoleptic properties of the meat, which is just a fancy way of saying that it tastes and smells differently at 10 or 12 days than it does at 8, which surprises me. But the reason I know that is because our research and development department just recently completed a thorough investigation into that topic. Specifically, we were trying to examine whether or not we could relax our shelf life standards just a little bit to take some pressure off the supply chain. And being a supply chain guy, I really would like to have seen that. It would have made my life a lot easier. But it didn't happen. So with such a tight shelf life specification, you can imagine that our supply chain has to be designed with contingencies in mind. If one of these patty processing plants not just shuts down, but even slows down, then it really puts a lot of pressure on us to keep that supply chain functioning. And that it could be equipment breakdown. It could be a snowstorm that keeps people getting into and out of the plant. It could be an E. coli test. You know, when the government comes in to sample, they take a random sample, which they do regularly for bacterial or pathogenic contamination in the meat. When they take that sample, then the plant has to shut down completely, and they have to do a complete sanitation of the whole system. And that takes 3-4 hours. So that's every time there's a sample taken, the plant's going to be down for 3-4 hours. It's a given. So these interruptions are inevitable. And they're going to happen, and they all present some real challenges to me and to my team to keep that supply chain functioning. So now that you've seen what the supply chain looks like, I want to shift gears and talk about the product attributes that are important to Wendy's. You can probably guess what they are. You've probably been to Wendy's once or twice. As a customer, what do you expect when you come to Wendy's? Well, you expect to find something that you want, first of all. You expect that it will taste good and be safe to eat. You expect that it will not cost you much. And you expect to get it quickly. It's a pretty simple formula, but it's pretty difficult to execute correctly. But those are the main reasons why people come to Wendy's. I think that among these five attributes, we look to the beef industry to help us with three of those. Those are a good-tasting, consistent product, a safe product, and cost stability. I'll talk about those. We'll start with a good-tasting, consistent product. Our sandwiches have to taste good. I mean, that's just one of the obvious keys to being a successful restaurant business. And they have to taste equally good in each of those 6,495 restaurants. Our customers should be able to pull up to any Wendy's knowing exactly what to expect, and they should get exactly what they expect every time, whether that restaurant is in Boise or Boston or Memphis or Sioux City. Consistency is the real virtue of the chain concept, when you think about it. It doesn't do you any good to have a whole bunch of stores if each store is going to be different, whether that's Wendy's or whether it's Outback or whether it's Walmart or Hy-Vee. The brand loyalty that chains develop is built on familiarity, and it's built on the ability of the brand to consistently deliver what the customer expects. I'm sure that you've been preached to over and over again about quality and consistency, but the redundancy of the message doesn't make it any less important, really. Granted, this is a bigger issue for restaurants and supermarket chains who sell roasts and steaks than it is for Wendy's. We sell ground beef. Let's face it, most of the issues surrounding beef quality and consistency have to do with marbling scores and tenderness. Well, I can't say the marbling scores are terribly important to Wendy's because our ground beef is always going to be blended to 75% lean. And I can't say that tenderness in the beef itself, which is beef trimmings, is terribly important either because our product is ground, and grinding is, after all, the ultimate tenderizer. Okay? Now, is there a difference in the taste of ground beef between different breeds? I don't know. We've never tested it. It's hard for us to have the opportunity to test it because generally packers don't segregate trimmings from different breeds of cattle, with the exception, obviously, of Angus. And they don't always segregate those either. But I can tell you that if there is a difference, and if our research and development team is given a means by which to test that difference, we will. I do believe that there's a significant difference in the between ground beef produced from cow carcasses as opposed to younger animals. I do believe that. That we have tested also. But within the steer and heifer classes, I'm not sure. So a good tasting, consistent ground beef patty is one attribute that obviously relates to your business, but it may be one that perhaps we might actually have more control over than you do, simply through tight control over our raw material specs, over our processing standards, and over our shelf life standards. The product safety is an area where I really think we need to work more closely together. To put it bluntly, if our customers are afraid that eating a hamburger is going to make them sick, they're not going to buy it. That would have a direct negative impact on beef demand. I want to emphasize once again that our customers and yours are one and the same. We're talking about two issues here, E. coli and BSE. Now, you and I both know that the risk of either one as a public health risk is very small. But that's because you and I are familiar with the advancements and the changes that the industry has made to reduce those risks. The average guy who drives up to a Wendy's or a McDonald's or Burger King probably has not read the latest press release from FSIS, and he's probably not going to. He only knows what he's seen on CNN or read in the newspaper. And that information can be incomplete, it can be inaccurate, it can even be biased, as you're all aware, I'm sure. The fact is, though, that we're not dealing with scientific reality alone. We're dealing with public perception as much as anything else. So we have to do everything we can, first of all, to prevent any sort of contamination to begin with. And second, to set up the processes that will effectively limit the damage should anything happen to occur. There's just too much at stake. From a practical standpoint, the E. coli bacterium is a much greater risk to public health than BSE. The Centers for Disease Control report that over the last several years, the number of E. coli contaminations in the U.S. has averaged 73,000 annually, and some of them fatal. So this is a known risk with some history behind it. Granted, some of these cases have been linked to swimming pools or lakes or unpasteurized milk or fruit juices and have nothing to do with beef. But once again, we're dealing with perception as much as we are reality. And whenever E. coli makes the headlines, beef is always implicated, justified or not. And justified or not, it's had the power to bring down an entire company, Hudson Foods, if you remember that. And it's caused severe financial damage to others like Jack in the Box and Monfort, which now, of course, is Swift & Company. It's had its impact on Wendy's as well. About 10 years ago, there was an incident in a Wendy's restaurant in the northwestern U.S., and I'm not sure that our business in that part of the country has ever fully recovered, even to this day, from that. So wherever it goes, it leaves a big footprint. Now, Wendy's can only control what happens after the cattle reach the slaughter plant. We have developed our own set of sanitation standards for both slaughter plants and patty processing plants, and we hold them to those standards. Each plant is audited at least twice per year, and an annual quality assurance review is held with each one, showing how each one ranks against all the other Wendy's suppliers. However, what happens before the cattle reach the packing plant is largely beyond our control. So we're looking to you to do as much as you can to reduce the risk up to that point. just exactly what those steps are, I don't think any of us knows precisely. But science is advancing pretty rapidly in this area. To quote the Centers for Disease Control once again, their figures show that over the last 7 years, the number of E. coli incidents has decreased 42%. So that's real progress. All I can do is to encourage you to stay abreast of the latest research and implement changes wherever they make sense and wherever they're practical. But I'm confident that they have already made a difference, and I'm confident they will make a greater difference down the road. Now, BSE is a different subject. To my knowledge, no one in North America has ever died of a brain-wasting disease from eating beef from a native North American animal. Yet, BSE probably represents a greater potential risk to our business than anything else. If you don't believe that, just look at what happened to the markets after December 23rd. This was a Canadian-born dairy cow, one animal, never got into the food chain, never posed a threat to public health, but the impact on the market was pretty severe. Very fortunately for Wendy's, we didn't see any noticeable impact on our sales. It pretty much ruined my Christmas vacation, but our first quarter same-store sales increased 9%. I would like to take that as an indication that our customers are better informed than we give them credit for, but I'm not sure. However, when the BSE incident in Canada was discovered 1 year ago last week, our business was not affected significantly there either. So that was the first case of BSE in a native North American animal. But what if there's a third case, and a fourth case, and a fifth case? The risk remains. The USDA says that they will test approximately 260,000 high-risk animals over the next year, including 20,000 otherwise healthy-appearing animals. And this is what frightens us the most, because what if BSE is found in an otherwise healthy-appearing animal, one of these 20,000 that they're going to sample, and which they have started, and I want to say it's going to start that part of it, I think, the 1st of June. So what if it's found in one of those healthy animals? It could happen. Won't that raise questions about where that animal's herd mates are? And if any of those cattle entered the food supply, and just where did that meat go? I mean, you can imagine, it could get pretty complicated. And if you haven't already guessed, I'm leading up to the issue of traceback. Unless we have a credible system that's capable of tracing each cow or steer or heifer back to its origin, it's going to be impossible to answer the questions that the public and the news media are going to ask. And as ridiculous as those questions might seem sometimes, we owe them honest answers. I mean, they are, after all, our customers. In a perfect world, we would be able to trace each box of beef all the way back to the ranch on which that beef originated. And we would know the location and the disposition of all of its herd mates, and we would be able to ascertain that information quickly. For that reason, Wendy's supports some sort of sensible, equitable, uniform animal identification system. Not to place blame on anyone, but simply to limit the potential damage and to beef demand and to the beef industry as a whole. It's apparent to me that nothing short of full traceback would allow future cases of BSE, or E. coli for that matter, to be discovered without any interruption in export shipments or domestic beef demand, and without excessive product recalls, for which we all pay the cost. Speaking of costs, we know that it's going to cost something to maintain all those millions and millions of records that a national animal identification system would require. And none of us knows exactly what that cost would be. We're still in the process of trying to decide what's the best technology to use and whether this is best implemented through governments or through industry. I don't know the answers. But it seems to me that the cost would most equitably be shared by everyone who holds a stake in the safety and integrity of U.S. beef. Most certainly you have an interest, so do feedlots, so do packers, so do we. So does the general public. But in all fairness, we have to consider the people who never eat beef. There are such people in America. You know, there are not many in the Midwest, but there are such people in America. And when you consider the possibility of using tax money to implement this sort of a program, then the vegetarian interest counts as much as anybody else's. Would you or I like to see our tax dollars go to some sort of a special avocado support program? I don't think so. There are a lot of details that need to be worked out. But in principle, a full traceback is a good idea that will benefit the beef industry in the future. Now, would Wendy's be willing to pay up for the ability to trace every box of ground beef back to its original source? Absolutely. There are limits, of course. But we view it as sort of like an insurance premium. Now, you sit down, you write a big check for your car insurance every year, and it hurts a little bit. Maybe $800 or $700. It hurts when you write the check, but in the back of your mind, you know that if you cause an accident and somebody gets hurt, it's going to cost you $500,000. Well, it's a similar sort of viewpoint. It's like paying an insurance premium. We know that the risk to our business, which really is the risk of doing nothing, is potentially devastating. And so we would like to see a sensibly constructed, sensibly implemented system that will be able to trace individual animals from the packing plant back to the herd of origin. Meanwhile, we are actively evaluating systems that will trace individual boxes of beef from the packing plant to the restaurant with radio frequency ID tags. It is possible today to determine in which plant, in what hour, and what minute that beef was produced. One way or another, that's going to become part of Wendy's supply chain. There's going to be a cost, but once again, what's the potential cost of doing nothing? There are two other things I want to address briefly before I finish. One is animal welfare. Our customers know that ground beef comes from animals. And a lot of them want to know, a surprising number of them want to know, are those animals treated humanely? We tell them, yes, they are. And they say, well, how do you know? Wendy's takes an active role in animal welfare, including cattle, hogs, and believe it or not, chickens. With the help of Temple Grandin, we have adopted a specific set of animal handling standards for all of our suppliers, and we hold our suppliers to those standards. Everything that happens between unloading from the truck and stunning is audited at least once a year in each plant. And if they fail those audits, they have a certain amount of time to correct the problem, and if they don't correct the problem, they don't supply Wendy's. It's the only enforcement tool we have, really. And we wouldn't do this if it were not important to our customers. The other thing we ask of our suppliers is some degree of cost stability. We don't change menu prices very often. Remember, we're trying to meet or exceed our customers' expectations every time. And one of those expectations has to do with the price of the meal. They want to see the same price on a combo meal every time they come into Wendy's. They don't want to see that price changing every 30 days. Well, if we hold our menu prices constant, that means that every change in food costs goes directly to our bottom line. Either goes into it or comes out of it. In an ideal world, we would lock in all of our food costs at a fixed price at least 12 months in advance. For some of the products, we're able to do that. For example, I know exactly what we're going to pay for lettuce for the next 3 years. Now, this sort of arrangement is not practical, of course, with fresh beef, if we want to be fair to our suppliers. And we do want to be fair to our suppliers. But we know that their cost of the trimmings that they sell to Wendy's is going to change every week. The trimmings that go into Wendy's hamburgers this week are coming from cattle that were bought last week. And as we are all aware, the cattle market can change dramatically in 1 week's time. Even so, I would like to see the market evolve into something that would allow beef buyers to better stabilize and manage their costs. That, we have to think about this for a minute, but that would help beef demand. At present, about the only viable risk management tool we have is the cattle futures contract. And that's useful. It's useful, but it's pretty complicated. There's the basis risk is huge, and there just aren't that many people out there who know how to use it to hedge their meat purchases. So what sort of evolution am I talking about? Well, generally, I'm talking about cattle prices being a little more closely tied to their value in the wholesale meat market. In other words, packers and feedlots pricing cattle based or tied to the cutout value, the beef cutout value. That would make it easier for beef buyers to hedge their costs using the cattle futures contract. Better yet, I'd like to see a futures contract for USDA box beef cutout values. The reason why price volatility, extreme price volatility, is detrimental to beef demand is because the less certain a restaurant operator is about his beef costs over the next 12 months, the more risk premium he's going to build into his menu price. And you got to think about this for a minute. Am I suggesting that more stable costs would lead to lower retail beef prices in supermarkets and restaurants? Yes, I am. What we all refer to as the wholesale to retail price spread would shrink. You may have to think about that. You may not agree with it. I'm convinced that it's true. And that's why risk management tools are important. That's why cost stability is important, and the evolutions that have been made, that we've really seen over the last 15 years in the pork market, have been a big help. And I would kind of like to see the beef market move in the same direction. Well, it's about time that I stop and let either John or John take over. I want to say that I really do appreciate the opportunity to be here. This is a real opportunity. I think there should be more of this. And there are, by the way, I got to say this, there are differences between opportunities and problems. You know, whoever it was that said there are no problems, just opportunities, right? Well, whoever said that, I think is full of crap. Because there is a big difference. And I hear this in my corporate world all the time. You know, if you're driving down the road and you see somebody has a flat tire, that's an opportunity. You pull over and you help them. And if that person happens to be Bill Gates, then it turns into a big opportunity. Well, if you're driving through the south side of Chicago, it's 10 o'clock at night, and you run out of gas or have a flat tire, you've got a problem. I'm sorry, but that is not an opportunity. That's a problem. So anyway, this to me is a real opportunity, and I appreciate